Welcome to HeCast, the official podcast of He Changed It. As always, I am Mike Chisholm. As always, I am so excited to be doing this. It is a highlight of my week to have these conversations with people around the topic of men's mental wellness. Doing that with all sorts of different people from all sorts of different walks of life. It is a great, great honor for me to do this. And it fills my cup. It just does. If you haven't downloaded the He Changed It app, what the heck are you waiting for? We know that it's still kind of in beta and it's still got things that are going on that are going to be fixed and added and all that sort of stuff. My wife and her team, the roadmap that they have will knock your socks off when you see what this app is going to be compared to where it is right now. But come on board, be an early adopter, jump on in, and let's change the world, because we really need to. We really need to. If you haven't subscribed to the podcast yet and you've just lurked, come on, jump in the pool, subscribe. Please also share it if you like what you hear or see. The He Changed It overlords love the metrics, and they love it when people subscribe and share this stuff. And we are very grateful for where we've come so far in this journey. It's cool. We're going to change the world, and that's the goal of this thing. Today, I have a really special guest. I say that every time. Every guest that does come on here is special. Yes. Okay. However, inside the little boy of Mike Chisholm, who is a gigantic hockey fan that never got a chance. I didn't come from money and I didn't get a chance to play hockey. So I live vicariously through those who did it and those who I admired. I hockey's like religion up here in Canada. You know, we're broadcast all over the world, but if you've listened to many of these episodes, you know I'm a Canadian, and hockey is my thing. I'm a gigantic Los Angeles Kings fan. Started when I was a little kid. I was the only happy Canadian when Wayne Gretzky was traded over to the LA Kings back in the day. And I'm just a gigantic fan of this thing. And I'm also a gigantic fan of broadcasting. I've talked a little bit about that on this podcast. And I've got a through line of broadcasters that have kind of made me who I am today and given me the love for doing this that I have. It goes from Mr. Rogers, a little bit of pro wrestling there with some Vince McMahon. Who else we got? And then, of course, I got handed over to David Letterman, who is my man. We've got Joe Rogan in there, a little bit of Kevin Smith. But for those who are not Canadian, you might not appreciate the fact that on Saturday night, we have something, and that something is called Hockey Night in Canada. When I was in my formative years, the mantle of the host of Hockey Night in Canada changed from a guy by the name of Dave Hodge to a guy by the name of Ron McLean, and he held that mantle. He held that baton for nearly three decades now, I guess, and is such a huge part of Canadiana. He is the broadcaster that a lot of us look towards when it comes to sport. But beyond that, Ron is a guy who has put his heart and soul so much into this that I don't know if he's the most well-liked Canadian out there, which is a big thing because Canadians are, we're pretty positive and we're well-liked, but he's definitely in the top 10 as far as I'm concerned. And Ron McLean has taken time out of his day to have a conversation with me today and be on HeCast. Ron McLean, thank you so much. I have a hard time not calling you Mr. I said it in the pre-interview. Thank you for taking time to be part of HeCast today.
Well, that was fantastic, Mike. You have found your calling. You mentioned your love of broadcasting and all those folks you mentioned who kind of serve as influences.
Yeah.
They ain't you. That was fantastic.
Oh, man. That means a lot to me. Normally, I'm all neat and tidy and stuff. I got the hair up and everything. Today, it's all about hockey hair, all of that stuff. I want to do a quick little bit of bio with you, but then I want to kind of talk a little bit about what the focus of this podcast is. You military brat, is it fair to say that's
yes,
that's what absolutely. You were growing up?
I was a rink rat and a military brat for sure. Those are the two things that kind of define childhood. And we moved around a lot. I was born in Zweibrücken in Germany.
Yeah.
My dad was actually stationed in Metz, France, but I was a breech child in mom's womb, and it was a bit of a complication, and the hospital just across the border into Germany was better suited to deliver me. It was a 48-hour labor for poor mom. Anyway, we lived in Metz, France, came to Victoria, went to Whitehorse, Yukon, back down to Nova Scotia, then out to Alberta, and so lots of uprooting throughout my childhood, and I was the only child, which, you know, obviously plays a role in who you become. And even with respect, Mike, to what you're doing here, I was thinking just sort of indirectly about all through my youth, my mom would come and sit at the foot of my bed after a tough day, and she would talk it through. She'd say, "Ronnie, I'm sorry. I was a little harsh there. You know, I was hot, and here's the reason I was out of sorts. It's not you." Whereas Dad was always the leave well enough alone guy.
Right.
He didn't communicate much, right? He held all things within, and maybe that's a little bit of his military, you know, team first. But yeah, it strikes me right from the beginning that in my life, a woman was, you know, better equipped to communicate, to open that needed conversation, to help offload some of what was within. Whereas Dad, you know, he held a lot of that within throughout his life.
There's a word that's been thrown around in our culture, and the definition has kind of changed over the years. And that word that comes up to me right now is the word privilege. And I think about what that word means now compared to what it meant maybe when I was growing up. And I think about some of the things that we have been given that we don't even understand are blessings to us compared to other people. On this podcast, one of the main topics, whether it's life coaches, whether it's counselors or therapists, that we talk about when it comes to men and where we are right now in this time and place in culture is vulnerability. And I'm just going to say this to you right now. I mean, so many guys in their 40s and 50s, they're just learning how to be vulnerable for the very, very first time. And when I'm hearing you say that, it's like, oh my God, what a privilege that you had a mom that taught you about being able to kind of empty your cup daily. I mean, my word, what a skill that was. Did it follow you your whole life, or was it something that you rediscovered?
No, it absolutely followed me. I had a lot of unconditional love, which can cut two ways, because unconditional love can almost give you privilege, the sense that whatever I do, I will be forgiven. And, you know, with that, maybe a lack of responsibility for your own actions. So you have to be careful with that. But I definitely had in me this this love that they both foisted on their only child. Call it spoiled, call it what you will. And I definitely had a sense of it's okay to be wrong. It's okay to be sorry. You know, a lot of the things that free you from your fears, they were given to me. And it really, like, I'm not kidding, Mike, I had tons of anxiety early in my broadcast career, a lot of fight or flight, a lot of panic attacks. And, you know, I thought, like so many people back in the 70s and 80s, that I was the only one that was, you know, so meek and mild and weak. And I had all those thoughts going through my head that other people can't possibly experience this, can they?
Yeah.
Of course, I would learn as we all grew through the point of emphasis on mental health, that it happens to many of us, if not all of us, at some point.
Yeah.
But mom and dad were there. You know, mom was always trying to teach me to know my place on the one hand, but also to have gumption on the other. They were great, just great mentors. And I think also because I was an Air Force kid and, you know, my life would be blown up. I was, you know, grade two, I'm all set. I know my hockey team. I know my school chums.
Yep.
Transferred. Dad's transferred down to Nova Scotia. I got to start anew. And this happened repeatedly. What was, again, a great blessing, though, is I saw that although there are differences in maybe what it is to be a Yukoner or a Maritimer, I also saw the sameness, you know, the oneness of each.
The things that bring us together.
That's right. So that was a nice gift.
You know, I was going to talk a little bit about Hockeyville and your role now as to where you've gone at the end, but let's kind of throw it in there right now. I think it's so interesting that as your career has evolved and where it is now and how you are constantly, you know, when we're not in a pandemic and even in the best of times in a pandemic, you're going from town to town now and seeing people and seeing the joy on people's faces. I mean, first and foremost, is there a week that goes by where somebody doesn't say, "I'm honored to meet you. I love meeting you," and the people across Canada, the diversity across Canada, you've seen that your whole life from when you were moving as a kid, and now, kind of where you're at in your career, you're seeing that diversity even more so now.
For sure. I was lucky to inadvertently train, right, for the career. And I also refereed, Mike. So refereeing would take me all over the provinces that I lived in and sometimes out of province to officiate.
You're a high-level referee, right?
I was a level five with Hockey Canada, which is high level. That gives you the qualification to do junior and university. And so I did a lot of, you know, the Vernon Vipers, who Aaron Volpatti played with.
Absolutely.
I refereed those games. So, significantly high level, but not a level six. Level sixers are the ones that do the Olympics or the World Junior Championships.
And okay, right.
My Hockey Night in Canada commitments, I rationalized, kept me from getting the level six. But I loved it. And, you know, that was an unbelievable exercise in human management. You were on the ice trying to communicate, fair rules of engagement, a level playing field, and you were working with all these different sensibilities. It's not unlike the code switching that as a broadcaster, you and I have to do now, is to try to think, okay, who's listening? What are their sensibilities, their proclivities? And it's so hard, right? Because when you're on Hockey Night in Canada, you're talking, if it's a big playoff game, maybe 5 million viewers.
Yes.
How do you connect? How do you speak in a way that, you know, like even when you mentioned the word privilege, right after Black Lives Matter, George Floyd, when we were having these really important conversations, that was kind of at the core of systemic racism. You really had to battle somebody my age and older to even get them to grasp systemic injustice or systemic racism.
Yes.
And I don't mean that to offend, but that's the problem, right? Everything you say starts to put up a wall right away. The notion that because you grew up with an advantage, whether you realized it or not, makes you a person of privilege.
Yes.
Well, that's just very offensive to hear. And it's hard to, you know, to find the way to nuance or finesse that particular messaging. And that's one thing refereeing did for me. It, for every fourth person that I would say, hey, six, we all saw that was hooking, but you're down 2-0. You know, if I call that, put you in the penalty box, they score on the power play, it's 3-0, we could all go home. The team needs you, so I'm going to let you away with it, but I need your help from here on in. It usually worked, but on the fifth time, the guy would say, oh, screw off, just make the call. You know, so you learned that whenever you got a little high on your horse thinking you're the great philosopher king, there was always somebody hearing your words differently.
The humbling that must come from being a referee. Like I announce, I'm the booth announcer for a junior B team called the Kelowna Chiefs, and so I get in the booth, and I'm the guy. I'm animated and docile when the visitor scores, and when our team scores, I'm all over the place. And I look at what the referees on that level go through, and from a fan perspective, from the ice, from the team owner sits in the box with me as I'm doing my announcing, and I hear, you know, what these people talk about, a thankless job and a job that's going to toughen you up and be a hockey referee. That'll do it.
Well, it's like being a teacher. It's like being a lawyer. It's picking a vocation or a politician. You know, I do think that's a really noble profession. You know, a lot of folks will, you know, look at it askance and say, oh, they just want the pension or they have, you know, selfish or egotistic motives.
Yeah.
But I happen to think these vocations are absolutely crucial, and officiating within all sport is one of those. And you kind of have to realize right at the get-go that everybody has a vested interest, whether it's the owner of the Chiefs, whether it's the fan that pays to go see the Chiefs, whether it's the player or the coach. But the one who shouldn't is obviously the official. They have to be the real arbiter, and they have to study at it. They have to think about it. They have to really figure out how to create, you know, rights from wrongs.
Yes.
It's a whole really complicated, and in our whole, again, society right now, as we decide, you know, what is the right amount or the proper approach to policing, what is the correct version of incarceration and the judiciary, right? Super complicated.
And absolutely. At least
officiating is a portal. I'm just saying it's a, you know, it's the back row of the church, but it's a pew in the same church of that conversation.
You know what? Leadership is lonely. And then you combine that with everything at its highest level is philosophy. And which means we're going to make mistakes. We're going to stumble forward. And hopefully the people who are leading are stumbling forward and can have that, those philosophical conversations and those philosophical decisions with the best interests of everyone in mind. And unfortunately, what we're seeing is polarization. And I remember going to my very first Kings game. They were in Vancouver. It was back when Gretz played for them, and it saved up. I was in high school, saved up money just so I could go see my Kings play for the first time. And Dan Marowelli was reffing, and I was blown away because I'd never been. It was Pacific Coliseum still. I had never been to a pro hockey game, and my mind was blown. At the size of it, all of that. But then when Dan made a call that the Canuck fans did not like. And back then, I mean, I don't know if the fans have changed that much, but it was like the words that were being thrown down at that guy for making one bad call. I believe that right there, those streetwise fans screaming the expletives they did and doing that is kind of a preview to the polarization that we have right now and that we've seen. Right. I want to talk to you about that. Definitely that polarization, because guys like you are really, really under the microscope now compared to when you started. But I'd want to talk about when you started, because you took over for Dave Hodge. You took over for Dave fucking Hodge. Like, holy cow.
Right.
How did that feel? I just want to know, like, talk about strange land.
Very uncomfortable,
like,
Mike, because, you know, Dave was a hero of mine, hero to all of us hockey viewers.
Yeah.
And it seemed really lousy the way he was sort of drummed out. I mean, yes. He had his job at CKNW in Vancouver. And truth be told, he was sick of flying from Vancouver to Toronto to
right.
on Saturday nights at Maple Leaf Gardens. He was just kind of spent. And
yes.
It wasn't within him. In a lot of ways, his situation and Don Cherry's situation, neither of them was really of a mind to say, sorry, it won't happen again and move on. They just said, go screw yourselves. I'm sick of dealing with all of this. But it left me in the lurch, right? I was very unpopular starting my career for having been the guy that replaced the martyr, who was
right?
trying to be the messenger on behalf of the viewer, who didn't get to see their overtime game that night. And Dave Hodge took the CBC to task and everybody at home was applauding. And then suddenly he's gone.
Yeah.
Young guy from Red Deer. Well, that was a very terrible way to begin a career. And then the Don Cherry thing, which almost bookends it, you know, all these years later.
Yeah.
Right back where I started. But honestly, Mike, again, you kind of have to, you just have to sort of say, well, why am I here? Who am I doing this for? And it's never about me. It is ultimately, as a referee and as a broadcaster, it is for the viewer, you know, and you just kind of have to use your empirical knowledge and say, all that I've learned says that the right thing to do right now is to try and do that job.
Right.
It's tough. It comes with an enormous amount of, I can't believe, you know, I just wanted to go and announce the Red Deer Rustler junior hockey games. Never dreamt that, you know, you fall into all these opportunities and then you fall into the crosshairs of all this judgment.
Yeah.
But there was my mom, you know, sitting at the edge of my bed saying, Ronnie, it's not you. It's we've had a bad day, and that's how I kind of view it. Everybody's upset and I don't blame them for being upset, and they are absolutely allowed to tell me they're upset. And I think to you and me, the job is we're not really a voice. We're an echo. We're an echo of all this stuff coming at us, and we got to distill it as best we can with the help of others and then put it back out there in hopefully a positive way.
I feel like I'm sitting under a learning tree right now. Like, I'm giddy. I'm a kid inside right now listening to this. Success leaves clues. You are, in the history of Hockey Night in Canada, in my opinion, the most successful face, voice of that program. You certainly are for my generation. I'm a Gen Xer. For my generation, you are that face of Hockey Night in Canada. It didn't start that way. Success leaves clues. What are some of the things, what are some of those clues that could be sprinkled on other people? Guys who are going through stuff right now, maybe they are transitioning into something. Maybe they're being forced to be stretched, to be evolved, but they don't necessarily look at it that way. They see it as a struggle they're going through, a trial they're going through. What are some of the perseverance, things that come to you, those personal development things?
Yeah, that it's a good question. I think, you know, patience is obviously the greatest. There is no substitute for hard work. We all know that. So you kind of work at it like Mother Teresa would say, you want to help yourself, help someone else.
Yeah.
So, you know, always put, like for me, especially Mike, with my anxiety, which was festering from the time I was 18 to about 35 years old. I'm 62 in April. But for those, and knock on wood, I mean, I could have a, you know, a moment of worry crop up at any moment. But lately, blessedly, I seem to be a bit past that.
Yes.
But in the you know, prime of my career, at a crucial time, I was, you know, walking on stage. Here's your host for the NHL Awards, Ron McLean. It's like, the hell is happening here? And then I'd have a panic attack. And, you know, I got a room full of people at a theater in downtown Toronto or the Air Canada Center. And I'm just like, God, I'm coming undone here. How am I going to get out of this? And usually the way I would work through it is a quip, some kind of a
sure
one-liner, which wouldn't resonate with everybody or land, especially in a room full of people who all don't want to laugh at the other's expense because it's the business. But I use that coping method to buy myself a little bit of time to stop hyperventilating. And nobody knew, right? It's crazy. And then finally, I'd say in my 30s, I got over myself. I finally stopped thinking, how does Ron look? What, you know, how did Ron perform?
Yeah.
And got back to, what the hell am I doing this for in the first place? It's in the service of others. It's to try and elevate everybody around and to have a good time. And then it kind of, you know, that anxiety seemed to wash away. There's a, you know, Thinking Too Well is, there's a book by Harold Bloom, who's a literary critic, Shakespeare critic principally, but he wrote about all the great wisdom writers, and he compared Cervantes and Shakespeare. And Shakespeare and Cervantes wrote Don Quixote. And that's the story of a 70-year-old retired teacher who wanted to be a knight and go around doing good deeds. And his first deed's a colossal failure, tilting at windmills. He thought, you know, these windmills were actually giants. Crazy stuff.
Yeah.
So he gets a peasant farmer, Sancho Panza, to help him. And then the wisdom of the book is revealed in the conversations with those two. I had Don Cherry, and Don and I, you know, we were different in so many ways, but we were so similar in a lot. And we would just sit and debrief day after night, night after day. And that was probably what kind of helped me get through, you know, even though I was sometimes the brunt of bullying and crazy stuff that we were doing, I could kind of laugh at it. I kind of equated it with your love of wrestling. I mean, I loved wrestling as a boy. I worked with a guy named Ed Whalen in Calgary.
Oh my God.
Wrestling. Yeah.
Canadian, so another Canadian legend.
Yeah. There was a lot of whimsy, you know, for me, there was whimsy in much, but that's, it was also a very innocent time. And it was also a time, you know, before Truth and Reconciliation, before Me Too, before Black Lives Matter,
yes.
You know, a time of a one dimensional, a skewed approach to levity that, yeah, it's crazy. It's an exciting time to sort of explore that right now. And I'm sure you'd agree with that.
Oh, 100%. I agree with it. I love evolution. I love growth. Yeah. I mean, that's what my wife and her team with the app, with He Changed It, is all about, is growing and becoming a different, a better version of ourselves, you know, a more improved version, a safer version, a healed version, all of these things. You know, you're learning or you're dying, you're growing or you're dying. Right. And we need to do that. Now that being said, the time that you got to kind of noodle around, this one dimensional time that you were talking about, what a fun time. Like the time that you kind of came up and got to find your voice on this international stage. And I say international because it is international. You're replaced Canada's Brian Williams, you know, the American Brian Williams, but you replaced Canada's Brian Williams on the international stage, Olympics, that kind of thing. You had found your voice by then. As you were finding your voice, you're hosting Coach's Corner, I don't even know the analogy to use. You had the leash around a roller coaster. I mean, maybe that's what it is. Yeah. It certainly wasn't an animal. You tried to rein in. And in my opinion, the tonnage of wins versus the tonnage of losses in that segment. I wish that we were in a society that wasn't so polarized and one little mistake could cost so much. And the weight of an apology could mean more than it does right now. But back then it did. it's not like you guys didn't have controversy back in the day. Like, I mean, I think about Don and the first one that came to my mind when I was preparing for this and going into my mind was European players coming over, Russian players coming over. You know, obviously many of the things said back in those broadcasts could never be said today because of the evolution that we had. But it's not like you guys were let off scot-free when it came to that stuff either. No. You have seen an entire culture shift in your broadcasting career where you could make mistakes versus a lot more complex and difficult to make mistakes now. That evolution, I mean, I'm just throwing things out there to you and we can discuss however we want to discuss it, but holy smokes.
There's a lot about that. First of all, I think one of the things that Grapes had going, Don Cherry had going for him was that we were CBC. So we were at arm's length from the government, which, you know, for some of the things that he would do, whether it was offend Quebec or offend Europeans, you know, he was all over the map with his, he didn't pick his spot. But there was always, you know, the political parties. It's almost like you had, you know, the conservatives would be backing this individual and his right to say it.
Right.
Versus maybe the Liberal or NDP or, you know, who would say this is really horrible for the collective and for the good of society.
Yeah.
But there was a balance there that kept him safe until we became Rogers. And now you have, you know, a corporate entity that's saying, oh my God, you know, we can't have all of half of our customers offended. So he, he kind of lost a little bit of his safety net when they moved away from a albeit at arm's length, still somewhat government influenced.
Sure, absolutely.
And that was, and then beyond that, I always felt, you know, he was different from my sensibilities, but he did speak for a lot. Like recently in the Globe and Mail, Lawrence Martin reported that there are 6 million Canadians who support Donald Trump. You know, well, those 6 million Canadians probably supported Don Cherry to the same extent because a lot of the hockey was mixed with politics. You know, and a version of the individual's autonomy versus again the collective and their needs. So it was great to have. Whether I liked it or not, I kind of liked it because it was fun. It was, you know, it was a bit of chutzpah to hear somebody with that particular tack. You know, I could have Margaret Atwood come in and straighten Don out and say, well, Don, the trickle-down effect doesn't work. You notice they don't say the windfall or the waterfall of benevolence. They say the trickle-down effect.
Right.
That's what it is. It's just a pittance coming to those who need it. And anyway, we'd have fun and we'd sit and argue over beer at night. And I was grateful. I felt, again, being a referee, it was like when I referee, I was trying to referee like I was holding a bird, right? Hold it too tight, you kill it. Hold it too loosely, it gets away on you. But you needed that, all these voices to be heard.
Yeah.
I was really worried that, and I feel bad that I lost it. You know, at the end of the day, it just got to the point there on that one specific day. I couldn't get back at Don and say, Don, I need you here to apologize for the sake of us, you know, and I think he was getting to that point where he just had his fill. As I said, Dave Hodge had kind of reached a point, I think, where at least in that year, and I shouldn't speak for Dave or Don, but I think they were just at a point where
they were done.
Yeah, they were done with that. And then, you know, you try to pick up the pieces. And blessedly, Kevin Bieksa rolls in and he's kind of got the same piss and vinegar.
He's got some fire. Absolutely.
Yeah, and a bit of sense of mischief. Now he's running scared because he knows, you know, one word here or one word there. I got caught last year in the playoffs and it's so easy to find yourself embroiled. But at least he's got a little bit of, you know, his father, who's a great orator and Big Al, he's NDP through and through. He's a union guy in British Columbia.
Yeah.
And I think Kevin is a mix of, you know, the conservative ideal of a self-made individual and his father's great, who actually does great speaking on behalf of mental health himself. And then Kevin Bieksa's got, you know, obviously Rick Rippon, who succumbed to mental illness that resulted in suicide. They're doing a big event on January the 21st. I don't know when this is airing. It's in perpetuity, obviously.
Right around there.
So they're doing a big Rick Rippon night and Kevin's got that, you know, he brings, and Don had that. Don was very good with mental health issues and LGBTQ2+ community issues. He was not, you know, a complete barbarian, but
no,
just on that one particular night, he projected an ideology or a behavior on a group, in this case, newcomers or immigrants. And we just needed to course correct and it didn't happen. It's too bad.
Well, and that's the thing, like, I don't know if it, maybe you have an opinion on this as a broadcaster from knowing where we were compared to where we are now. But there used to be a measure of grace for that. And that measure of grace seems to be disappearing, in my opinion, to the detriment of our society, because it just creates more of that polarization and more of that tribalism, right, whatever you want to call it. Do you think the pendulum can swing back? Like, do you think that there's going to be a place where it's like, okay, you know what?
Oh, it must.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, the Puritans came to North America to create a puritanical nirvana, you know, and it didn't become that. Now it had horrible, you know, I don't have to get into all the things that were wrong with America, but you know, I think the pendulum's always swinging a little bit, and you know, this was an important few years, as I said, for all the reasons that we had sort of social activism, some of it born of, you know, social media and the power of you know, it used to be that, first of all, it used to be the New York Times and the National and CBC. You know, it was a vertical pronouncement about what's going on in our world, and we all listened.
Yep.
You know, now it's coming at you on a horizontal plane, and that's good. You know, that does create, but it also creates the, you know, the factor that, you know, we tend to listen to what we want to listen to, and it's unfortunate because you don't have a broad range of viewpoints. And that's why, as you and I are discussing here, it's a shame that you couldn't say, well, Grapes is, you know, he's up there and he's of a time that represents something that we don't believe in now, but we can forgive him and not demand that he change at that age. You know, completely. And that was a tricky dynamic. And, you know, he's great. I was over at Christmas time, and I go by, you know, on his birthday's February 5th, and June 1st is the anniversary of Rose's passing. And we mark milestones together and we talk, and, but it's very, it's laced with melancholy for sure. But honestly, it's also just 33 incredible years of hijinks.
33 years. Oh, I love that. I love the word mischief. I love the word hijinks, because I look at them as a positive, obviously not damaging or anything like that. I love that you use that word to describe it, because that's kind of how it seemed. It seemed like that was the part of the broadcast. And I mean, there are other ones too. Like, I love the hot stove, and I love these other things, but the Coach's Corner was something that was just, it's special to a lot of people, and it lives in our hearts. And I'm really grateful. I was going to ask about if you guys are still friends and you guys are still tight. And I mean, that's the way the cookie crumbles, so we accept it and move on. I'm grateful to hear that you guys still are. I think a lot of people who see or hear this are going to feel the exact same way. You know, are you nostalgic? Are you a nostalgic guy, Ron?
Well, yes, I would have to say, there was a book, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, about two guys going across the plains on motorcycles. And one was a classicist and one was the romantic. The romantic, if his bike broke down, he would get on the phone and get someone over to fix it, whereas the classicist could repair it himself.
Yes.
I'm on that romantic side. So
me think too. 100%.
It's let someone else do something, and I want to learn about that, you know, and watch and admire them do their thing. And so in that sense, I'm nostalgic, because I had great respect for, you know, like Betty Davis,
Betty White.
Betty White, thank you.
Yeah.
You know, Betty White's passing. I remember doing a video for somebody who was a huge fan of the Golden Girls. Yeah. And I rolled in a little clip of what Betty White said on the show. And oh my God, you know, again, just not a chance in 2022 that we could run that, what Betty White said. But I love it. And you know, I grew up with Johnny Carson. And I used to go, it's funny, now that I'm 62, when I started with Don Cherry, he did a show called The Grapevine, which was a TV show. They'd interview a guest for a half an hour, and they had a fake bartender. Jimmy Loftus was an actor who was the bartender at The Grapevine. And
right.
I would listen to Jimmy Loftus tell stories, and they were about James Cagney and all these people that I didn't know, right?
Yes.
And I thought, wow, it's kind of sad that he's speaking to me and I can't grasp what he's speaking about. And now I'm that guy. You know, I got to really watch when I go do a talk, even though I think we're both in the same boat, we're more listening nowadays than talking. But yeah, that's something that has really hit home with me with respect to nostalgia. It's not you know, it's not connecting or hitting the mark with everyone.
Yeah, no, I feel where you're coming from when you say that. I'm a big fan of the transfer of knowledge. I love the, one of the things that I am concerned about where our culture is right now is the fact that the transfer of knowledge, I think, is getting affected a little bit because people are throwing the babies out with the bathwater. Right. Because you feel a certain way about this issue, everything else you have to say is also discredited as well. And I think we need to come back to a place of civility. I'm the guy who says bad speech shouldn't be censored. Bad speech should be countered with better speech and more better speech. And it gets thrown around that way. To me, that's common sense, and common sense will prevail. But then there are some times where I see what's going on and I'm like, oh my God, I don't know if common sense is going to prevail when it comes to this. It's gotta, right?
Well, it has become very preachy. It has become very prosecutorial.
Yeah.
I can't even say that word, but that's unfortunate, right? You're right. It's ultimately polarizing, and we need to bridge these gaps somehow, some way. I mean, you watch what's going on in the United States right now, and it's happening in Canada to an extent too, and it took a pandemic as a separate story. But of course the whole, approach to a pandemic, vaxxers, anti-vaxxers, polarizing.
Yes.
And to bridge these gaps, it requires common ground, if not common sense. And I don't know who, because as I said, when I refereed and I thought on that night where I was a great manager, I'd suddenly get my comeuppance. I was very humbled by, but there's a lot of, wisdom trains, and that's where your point is right. Shakespeare will always be. And a lot of, what our First Nations have taught us, Chief Stacey Laforme is the chief of the Mississaugas of the Credit, is the land on which I'm doing this down in Ontario. And I remember we had him on Rogers Hometown Hockey in Niagara Falls, which is part of his territory as well.
Yeah.
And he said after he did his little on-camera stuff, he said, Ron, by the way, if you're ever having problems with, marriage, relationships, workmates, anything. He says, I'm really good at that stuff, so don't hesitate to call. And I thought, wow, what an interesting thing to say. And I've taken him up on it, And so there's wisdom, so much wisdom in so many different realms, that we can tap into.
You just alluded to something you said earlier as well, and how many times when we're going through something, we think we're the only ones who are going through it. And that's certainly something that my wife Candace and her team are trying to break down. The way that they talk about it is that men go into silos. And we go into these little silos thinking that it's just us. You just saying that somebody reached out to you and said, hey, look, relationships, work, whatever, I'm here for you. And you've taken him up on it. We think about, there's so much more that unites us than divides us. That's an old tired cliche, but it's not untrue. It's extremely true. And when men can do that and can share, first off, becoming aware of what it is that's going on. Many times we've got our blinders on and we don't even know that we're not feeling very good. Once we become aware of it and that vulnerability, how important is it to be able to share this stuff with others?
Yeah, I think it's everything. Sheldon Kennedy's probably like the best influence for me on that particular notion. And he to this day, he said, I have to know who I can speak to, but I might have suicidal thoughts. I might have, problems that are starting to build within. And the only way that I can solve the problem is to speak to somebody and offload some of that, not to burden them. Usually that's why I kind of weigh who I'm going to tell something, knowing whether they have kind of the wherewithal or they're comfortable with it. But I do need to talk. And that's back to the power of conversation with Don Quixote, Sancho Panza, and Don Quixote. In the case of Shakespeare, it was Hamlet and Falstaff.
Yeah.
If you don't have that somebody to offload and to sort of flush things and flesh things out, you're really going to dwell. And that's it's not a good place to be. We can't do it alone. This is Tyler Smith. You and I were discussing, Ryan Stresnitsky has done the podcast and,
yeah,
the Humble Bronco story for me will be probably the one, most incredible, epiphany of my time on earth. to walk into Royal University Hospital in Saskatoon 36 hours after the crash. The young man who did this Not Alone t-shirt, and he uses different words. One might be vulnerability. One might be courage. Tyler, as he was being airlifted over to Saskatoon to the hospital, you know, he awakened and they asked him who he was and he didn't know. And they asked him what had happened. And he didn't know. He says, but I know my mother's phone number. And that's how they were able to identify Tyler. And I walked into
the whole
scene in the hospital of you know, misidentified patients, because they were all, they'd bleached their hair in a playoff run.
Yep.
And they all looked the same, fit, young, blonde, you know, men. And yeah, two of them were spinal cord injury right away, Ryan Stresnitsky and Jacob Wasserman. And I remember speaking to Wasserman's parents and just saying, you don't know it right now. And I know you probably won't remember a word of what I'm saying to you. It's all so raw, but he will have a great life. He will have a great, great life. And it's hard for you to fathom that right now. And you're concerned, and I know you are, and who knows what the prognosis is, but if he is paralyzed, please know he's going to have a fantastic life. And I could give you so many examples that would, but you're not going to retain any of this right now, but please know that. I remember Grape saying to me, Ron, you're not a priest, you know, like, but I had done a lot of work with spinal cord injury and felt very, very strongly about, you know, again, it's just, we're so hooked on hope and fear, you know, and the whatever change you're aiming for. Fear is that it's going to be a bad change and hope is it's going to be a good change, but it's just lacks acceptance.
Right.
And, yeah. We need that acceptance. And then you just need to, in the case of Ryan, as he probably explained, I don't know if it was Chris Cedarstrand or he could list Dwayne Danes, a rodeo cowboy, lots of influences, lots of mentors, peer counselors who are absolutely so helpful. And that's why he changed it. It's just that reaching out to a resource that can suddenly say, aha, it's not just me. And here's how, because that's the next thing. You need the action, right?
Yes.
What are you going to do? It's all well and good to, you know, oh, there's a recovered alcoholic. Oh, there's a recovered, you know, trauma victim. But we need to know how, and we need some of the tools, or, you know, it could be as simple as exercise, could be a million things.
Absolutely.
But it's all right there for one's asking.
Again, I don't know how else to say it other than I feel like I'm sitting under a learning tree right now.
Mutual.
Well, oh my gosh. I want to talk about purpose for a second here. Like 36 years total hockey in Canada. Is that the number right now?
That's right.
Okay. When you took over that job, because there's a lot of guys out there right now who, purpose is a thing. Many therapists and counselors and whatnot, men's coaches that we've talked about have talked about how guys, they do the paint by numbers or they connect the dots they were supposed to connect. They get good grades if they can, go to university, get a degree if they can, get a good job. If not, get a good job either way, get married, get the house, all of that. They do all the things that are on the task list, which many men are good at doing, from a logical perspective. Okay, here's your task list. But then, you know, they realize that there's some things that aren't fulfilling them. It strikes me just in the way that you would deliver whatever it was, when you're doing what you're doing, whether it was hockey, whether it was something beyond hockey, that you seem to be living your purpose. Was it the broadcasting or was it the things outside of the broadcasting with the relationships that was it? And am I correct in saying that you were living your purpose?
Yeah. You know, it's funny, Mike, I was never a goal setter, right? So I kind of stumbled into, I had no ambition to get into broadcasting. I got a call out of the clear blue from a radio station because a buddy of mine in high school was sick. He was the guy that was going to push buttons for 9 hours, very simple, rudimentary operating at the radio station.
Yeah.
But he couldn't come in and he said, phone Ron, he'll figure it out. Might have to teach him for an hour. And I got a call and one thing led to another. And I always loved the, you know, as an only child, I spent a lot of time in my room watching television, listening to the radio. I would sit in front of my Panasonic radio in Red Deer, Alberta, and tune in Raccoon Carney on CFUN Vancouver, or Jay McPhail, or Tom Lucas, or all these great broadcasters in Vancouver. Plus, I'd listen to the ones in Edmonton and Calgary.
Yep.
And I was fast. By now, I was kind of getting the bug because I'd been brought down to a radio station. And once I got a taste of it, I thought, wow, what a nice way to make someone's day. And I think in terms of my purpose, I never had, again, a goal of being on Hockey Night in Canada. I had no idea what I was doing. I kind of liked a show like you're doing now. I wanted to speak to someone. I was a captain of all the hockey teams I played on, president of the students' union at school. Inadvertently, because I was an only child, I think I was a really good neighbor. I was always needing friends to be part of my unit. And I was a good, because I'd been in Yukon and Nova Scotia and British Columbia, I was good to be able to take the, you know, hardcore conservative values and combine them with some of the hardcore liberal values and see that, you know, the good in everybody and try to work to make us come together and get along.
Collaboration. Absolutely.
Yeah, collaboration. So that was kind of how I approached the career. It was just, you know, wherever I go, I'll try to behave as if I'm one of the captains and elevate. You know, Gord Downie,
yep.
When they did the last tour of the Tragically Hip, we were at the Empress in Victoria. That was stop one, was Victoria. And we were back at the bar in the Empress Hotel, and Gord Downie and his brother Patrick are standing at the bar with me. And at that point, it was Nick Kyprios, Kelly Rudy, Elliot Friedman, and Gord Downie is saying, Ron, you're coming back, because George Strombolopoulos had kind of taken the key role for two seasons, which again was all great by me. I was going to do hometown hockey and happy to play on the fourth line as long as I'm one of the captains. I'm kidding. But Gord Downie said, you know, your job will go swimmingly, Ron, as long as you remember to elevate those guys. And I know you will. And he's right on the money. That's the kind of the core of what I do, is to serve, to allow someone to have a voice. And I don't correct too often if I'm on my game, but sometimes I love to argue as well. And my mom and dad, that's another thing they taught me, is it's great to hash it out. Dad, as I said, was a leave well enough alone guy, and he would stop at some point and shut it down.
Yep.
But my mother was, you know, a good needler and a good provocateur. So that's a part of the gig that you enjoy, or I enjoy.
I found, now this might be just my, I was growing up watching you and Don Cherry do your back and forth. I felt, over the years, this could just be my perception of growing up, or it could be reality. You'll be able to tell me the reality part. I felt that over the years, when you talk about sometimes you got that little argumentative streak, over the years, you got good at calling Don on shit sometimes, compared to at the beginning.
Oh, for sure.
Well, it evolved that way, right?
I got hauled in, Mike, year two. So maybe even year one, after Dave Hodge left, there was a gentleman from the CBC named Bob Cornell. Beautiful guy. He was second in command at CBC. And we have a meeting at the Chelsea downtown hotel, downtown Toronto. And he said, Ron, you are now the host of Hockey Night in Canada, and you represent the CBC, and you are a journalist. We can't have Don Cherry running a roughshod over you. I said, yeah, but Bob, I'm 26. And and Don's best friend in hockey is Bobby Orr, and his best friend in coaching is Brian Kilray, who's won 1,000 games in Ottawa. He says, how the hell am I going to, you know, correct him? How am I going to hold him, you know, to account? Now, granted, if he was drifting off, as he so often did, into politics, I suppose that put us on an even keel. But I mean, at the get-go, I always kind of had it in my head, Mike, that I'm 26.
Yeah.
And this goes back to my mom. Like when I was a boy, I'd come out into the living room and we'd have company in the house, and I'd be, you know, I was a real talker. So I was, you know, showing off somehow, some way, my verbal acumen. And my mom would finally say, Ronnie, okay, that's enough. You know, back to your room, or, you know, almost to kind of a know your place.
Yep.
Within. And I felt that in the hierarchy of the show is like, for God's sakes, you're, you know, Dick Irvin, Bob Cole, Harry Neal, Don Cherry.
Yeah.
You just service and give them what they need. Because, you know, bless his heart, Dave Hodge said to me when I took over, he says, no, well, don't let Don dictate the subject matter. it's a noble, and he's right, I suppose, to an extent. But I just thought, nah, I want him to shine. I want Don to shine his own light and be who he is. And I'll do whatever it takes to facilitate him and the next person that I meet.
Well, and I'll say this, I believe that he shined more when you call him on shit, when you actually.
For sure. Because he's so quick. Like, yes, you're right. they always said of Wendell Clark, the hockey player, is the fastest. Scotty Bowman said this. He was the fastest 6 seconds of anything, whether it was a flurry of fists or jumping into an opening or throwing a hit. And Don, because I think he was a little more unfiltered, yeah. I think, because he didn't really he did weigh the consequences. I should be really careful about this. He was a sharp, like a fox, right? In the sense that he knew usually what would undermine him, which is why at the end I thought, okay, Don's just decided, and he even says,
right,
in a handwritten letter, you did what you had to do and I did what I had to do. But oh my, he was quick, when we would start to, filibuster or argue, he was lightning fast on his feet. And it's a very impressive attribute. I mean, he's just a super skilled, well-read, well-informed, he said, Ron, you live in the land of Billiken, which is a doll that was popular in the early 1900s in St. Louis. And it was Billiken was the god of how things ought to be. And he says, you live in the land of Billiken. And there's a lot of truth in that. So it was a good marriage in that regard. His practical or pragmatic approach and my romantic or nostalgic.
Yeah. You speak to me. I'm the romantic. I'm the optimist. I've always been that guy as well. And it goes back to when you started the radio station, you just wanted to, how can I make someone's day better? How can I make someone, I adore that, because I believe that that's just what we need to do. If we can make somebody's day better, it makes, Letterman said this, and somebody was asking him a question and they were talking about, okay, well, Letterman says it's selfish to be nice to people because you feel so good, or to be great, to be right, generous to people because you feel so good in making them feel good. It's almost a paradox when it comes to that. But it's a beautiful paradox. And you clearly are that guy. We are getting into overtime right now. I'm going to be selfish for a moment. I'm going to say thank you on behalf of the viewers for being here and doing this and talking about this. Success does leave clues. You've left a lot of clues. You left a trail today. And I'm so, so very grateful for the support. I'm grateful you know that He Changed It is even in existence. I'm super grateful about that. Now's where I get selfish. I'm a gigantic LA Kings fan. Gigantic. In 93, when Grapes was wearing the suit, they were going on to the finals on the ice for the first. Like, I've got so many memories of the LA Kings and you guys. Do you have any LA Kings memories you can share with me?
Oh my God. First of all, when they,
and by the way, Kelly Rudy's on my hit list as well. And if you can make that happen, I will
put in a great word. Kelly, as you know, is unbelievable in the arena of mental health.
And, yes.
He's done a phenomenal job. But yeah, when they beat Toronto in 93 to qualify for the final, do you remember that?
I figured we were going down here. Yeah, absolutely.
So I go into the dressing room at Maple Leaf Gardens. Gretzky's got a hat trick. They win the game. They're going to the final against Montreal.
Yep.
And I go into the room to interview the players, most of whom have already stripped off their LA Kings sweaters.
Yeah.
And a guy comes up to me and he says, Ron, you got to get me on. And I had no idea who it was.
Oh, no.
I looked at him and you know how that can happen. He was a younger player.
100%.
I just had no clue who this guy was. So now I'm doing the process of elimination. There's Wayne. I'm going around the room thinking, okay, if I should be able to figure it out. And it was Warren Reichel.
Oh, Warren Reichel.
Not a real, big name or anything. But I do remember vividly that. And the other story I'll tell you is just my favorite. Wayne Gretzky's a great storyteller. I'm so grateful he's doing TV now, even though it's in the U.S.
Yep.
But so we go down and we're in the old Inglewood Forum, the Great Western Forum.
Yep.
And he's telling a story that he likes. It's just a story. We're having coffee before they're going to take to the ice for their morning skate at L.A. And he tells a story about Bobby Clark, was just in the news yesterday. But Bobby, he's telling a story about Dave Brown, a big enforcer who came into the NHL. And Dave Brown was with the Flyers and he was sitting next to Bobby Clark, who was still captain of the Flyers.
Yep.
And Dave Brown said to Bobby Clark, he says, I want to make an impression. I want to, show the coach what I'm made of and who should I maybe go? Cause they're playing the Boston Bruins. He said, who should I go after tonight? And Bobby Clark says, Dave, he's look, you're a tough guy and you're a great kid, but you're a kid. These guys are men. They'll kill you as soon as they look at you. You got to be very careful. You go out there, you wreck your shoulder in the first 5 minutes and that'll be the end of your career. So if somebody challenges you, you have to respond, but don't go looking for trouble. That's the biggest advice I'll give you is don't you start something.
Okay.
You're just a kid. And then Bobby got up to go over to where the urinals were in an adjacent room. And while he was at the urinal, he hollered back into the dressing room. Of course, I never cared for that Milberry. Those were the marching orders for Dave Brown. Go get Milberry. And Wayne had such a smile on his face telling that story. That's what I remember about everywhere we ever went to hear Wayne talk hockey. That core, why he was so great. You know, he was a beautiful person, always uplifted. He picked the Olympic team in 2002. He chose Theo Fleury, had just come through, you know.
Yep.
Eric Lindros had just had his shoulder blown to bits, not to mention the concussion with Stevens. Michael yep. Pekka just missed a year in the NHL in a contract squabble. He brought all these, you know, different versions of a reclamation project to the games at Salt Lake, and they won the gold medal. And that's Wayne. He just knows everyone's story, and you were lucky to be a Kings fan.
Oh man, I'm gonna take that. I'm gonna make that my ringtone. Ron McLean telling me I'm lucky to be a Kings fan. I the gratefulness is pouring out of me. I hope you can feel it through the through this this technology that we have here. Ron, thank you for taking time out of your day. I cannot wait until our paths cross again. You know, Cowboys say they don't say goodbye; they say see you later. I can't wait until I see you later. Until he is doing what my wife and her team desperately and with their hearts and all of their passion hope it's going to turn into what it turns into. And maybe we're making a deal with the NHL. Maybe we're making a deal with Rob. I don't know what it's going to be, but I know that somehow, some way, our paths will cross again. And I can't tell you how grateful I am for what that is going to be, because this conversation today has been a literal dream come true for me. Thank you for who you are. Thank you for wiring my subconscious pathways with all of the hours that I have watched you. You are a hell of an influence, and you are worthy to be called an influence. Thank you very, very, very much today, Ron.
Great, Mike. Right back at you.
Oh man. Okay. They go by real quick. As I like to say, time gets slippery as we do these shows. That is another episode of HeCast, the official podcast of He Changed It. My name is Mike Chisholm. Go change something.